I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order, and we're going to start out with a public hearing. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 901A.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that comes to you from Senator Burdick and Representative Greenlick. It exempts amateur athletes from certain specified employment regulations that are related to workers' compensation coverage, wage rate, payment, collection and claim enforcement, employment conditions, employment of minors, and unemployment insurance. There's a minimal expenditure impact and a minimal revenue impact, and there are no amendments today.
Thank you. So, was this one? Mm-hmm. We'll have Representative Greenlick come up and get us started. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for having this hearing today. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, which is right across the river from the Moda Center and the Coliseum. When I first moved to Portland, well, it was 50 years ago or something like that, there was a professional hockey team in Portland. It was the Portland Buckaroos. They were a great team. They were a minor league team right below the National Hockey League. And they sent a lot of players to the NHL, and I think that it lasted probably 10 years after I got here, but then economics took away the professional team at the minor league level, and we had a lapse where there was no hockey for the hockey fans in the Portland area. Then along came the Western Hockey League and the Portland Buckaroos, a very high-level amateur team. You'll hear more about the team and the dynamics of it from somebody who actually knows something, rather than somebody who just sat in the stand and watched them play. They're a really fun group of young people, prepping, trying hard to facilitate their dream of becoming a National Hockey League player someday. And many of them actually do make it to the National Hockey League. But the issues come up as to whether this amateur team is really an amateur team. And these people, these young people, 16, 17 years old, really employees, or are they really amateurs? I'm here to say they are really amateurs. You'll hear more about them. They should be treated as amateurs. They're treated very nicely. They have scholarships available, a variety of other things, but basically they're amateurs. And it'd be really important not to get them caught up in Oregon wage and hour law. And this has been settled, I think, in Washington already. There are, I believe, 4 Western hockey teams in Washington and only 1 in Oregon. So with that, I'll turn the stand over to somebody who knows something.
He's not talking about me.
We knew that.
Are there any questions for Representative Greenlick?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's interesting to hear the history of the Buckaroos.
So, around town.
He's in judiciary now. Okay.
I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 901 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 838.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure from the Senate Business and Transportation Committee. It excludes persons who are not developers of timeshares from compliance requirements for the provisions governing timeshares. It also modifies the definition of developer. No amendment today.
Great. Representative Vile.
Chair Holby, Vice Chairs Bynum and Barreto, members of the committee. I'm joined here by Karna Gustafson, an industry specialist that works with homeowner associations and particularly timeshare communities. And I'd ask her to take just a moment to explain the bill to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Holy, Chair and Vice Chairs and members of the committee. My name is Karna Gustafson. I'm an attorney with Landy Bennett Blumstein. I also sit on the nonprofit organization Community Association Institute, which is the education arm trade association for homeowners associations. This bill is intended mostly as a cleanup bill. We believe the law is the way it is that exempts associations that foreclose on timeshares from having to file a public report and the other documentation with the Oregon Real Estate Agency, but we thought it would be important to provide some clarification, so that's what this bill does. It exempts associations and parties that foreclose from having to file the public report with the real estate agency. Representatives from the real estate agency are in the room, but they also sit on the committee that discusses this legislation as a resource to us, and this has been vetted through them.
Chair Holvey, Vice Chairs Bynum and Barreto, members of the committee, Rich Vile, House District 26. The problem is this. If a developer goes back in and acquires or has a lot of units remaining out of a timeshare property, or a developer acquires from another developer, they really have to file the consumer protection documents. What we're trying to avoid, as you probably are aware, a lot of timeshare units end up going back to the folks that originally sold them, or in many cases, they go back to the homeowners association itself because of unpaid assessments. A lot of folks buy a timeshare, don't ever pay their assessments on that timeshare. The homeowners association doesn't have the money then to maintain the property. They need to foreclose on the unit, get that timeshare back so that they can resell it. This allows the homeowners association to take that project back after foreclosure, not have to file all of the developer type of documentation with the real estate division before they resell that unit. It's not opposed by anybody in the industry, not opposed by anybody that we've talked to. There's been no concerns raised about the bill at any point, and we'd urge your passage of the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? It looks like we're questionless for you today. So thank you very much walking through the bill with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 838? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 838, and we'll go back and reopen Senate Bill 901A. And already receiving the description of the bill, we'll have Tim Bernasek and Doug Piper.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Bernasek. I'm an attorney at Dunn Kearney, here today testifying in support of Senate Bill 901, representing the Portland Winterhawks and the Western Hockey League. With me is Doug Piper, the president of the Portland Winterhawks, and just want to start out by telling you we appreciate the support of Representative Greenlick and Senator Burdick in helping us put the bill together and moving this forward. As you may know, and as Representative Greenlick testified, the Portland Winterhawks players are registered amateur athletes under rules established by USA Hockey and Hockey Canada. They play at the highest level of amateur sport in the United States and Canada, and the Portland Winterhawks are one of five teams in the United States in the Western Hockey League. 17 others are up in Canada, and so it's a very Canada-focused league, but obviously there are a couple of teams here in the United States. As amateur athletes, the Portland Winterhawks players have traditionally been exempted from the workers' compensation system, and they're specifically exempted in ORS 656-027-13. And the understanding has always been that they were not, as amateur athletes, like amateur athletes generally, are not covered by wage and hour and other employment laws. But the reason we're here today is that a class action lawsuit has been filed in Canada alleging that all Canadian Hockey League players, of which the Western Hockey League is a member of and Portland Winterhawks are a part of, should be considered employees. And In discussions with the attorneys involved, they feel very good about our case, but in an, perhaps overabundance of caution, the strategy of the league has been to go through several Canadian provinces and the state of Washington and now Oregon to just clarify specifically what has been the common practice, that these players are in fact amateur athletes and are not employees. And the state of Washington dealt with this in 2015, and it was very non-controversial up there. We had very good treatment in the Senate, unanimous vote, and now we're here in front of the House. And so, again, Senate Bill 901 would do the same, clarify this issue for Oregon. What we've done, it's a little bit interesting in Oregon because our work comp statutes had already arguably covered this by making it clear that amateur athletes that are declared amateur athletes under the rules of the U.S. Olympic Committee and the Canadian Olympic Committee, we were already arguably covered. And the initial attempt in legislation in my discussions with the Legislative Council was to just take that language and apply it over into the wage and hour statutes. But as we got looking at this a little bit closer, some question came up as to the efficacy of the current legislative language in the work comp statutes. As you may know, NHL players, NBA players now play in the Olympics, and they maybe didn't 30 or 40 years ago when this exemption was originally passed. And so we decided that it was probably time to update the existing exemption first. And so what we did is we again, the idea is not to broaden it necessarily, but just clarify that any amateur athlete like the Portland Winterhawks players that are registered with the governing body of amateur sport for that sport, so USA Hockey, Hockey Canada, USA Football for high school football, for example, would be exempted from not only work comp if this bill passes, but the wage and hour statutes as well. So that's essentially what the bill does. I will turn it over now to Doug to give you a little bit better idea and understanding of how the team operates, how the players are taken care of, and just the wonderful program that it really is for these athletes that are trying to take it from the amateur status and become professionals. But we'd be happy to answer any questions if you prefer after Doug is done with his testimony. Again, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Piper. I'm the president and governor of the Portland Winterhawks Hockey Club. The Portland Winterhawks is a member of the Western Hockey League, which is the western branch of the Canadian Hockey League, which has over 60 teams members across North America. The CHL and the WHL have been recognized for over 50 years as one of the world's finest development leagues for amateur hockey players. The WHL consists of 22 teams, with 17 based in Western Canada and 5 based in the Pacific Northwest. The U.S. division consists of the Portland Winterhawks, Seattle Thunderbirds, Everett Silvertips, Spokane Chiefs, and Tri-City Americans. The WHL also partners with amateur sport governing bodies, USA Hockey and the U.S. Olympic Committee. The Portland Winterhawks have been part of the fabric of Oregon for over 40 years. We employ nearly 40 full-time staff members and hundreds of part-time employees, playing in both the Veterans Memorial Coliseum, where we are the primary tenant, and the Moda Center, home of the Portland Trailblazers. Our economic impact to the region is in the millions of dollars annually. To give you an idea where the Winterhawks fit into the hierarchy of sports, our players are the equivalent of college football or college basketball players. In those sports, the accepted path to the NFL or the NBA is through the college system, but that's not the case in hockey. In hockey, the Western Hockey League is the most successful league in preparing young men for the National Hockey League. Currently, the Winterhawks have nearly 25 alumni that are now playing in the National Hockey League. Next month, one of our current players, Cody Glass, is expected to be drafted into the NHL in one of the top 5 positions in the first round of the draft. The ages of our players range from 17 to 20, again, similar to all college age. Up until the time they come to play with us, their families bear all the expense of having their children compete within the hockey system. This can mean tens of thousands of dollars in expense per child per year. Once they reach our level, all that expense for the family is eliminated. Our system provides the players with all of their housing, meals, transportation, ice time, coaching, and most importantly, education. In addition to receiving the finest hockey education and experience, our players also receive an academic education. The WHL provides resources such as tutoring and other education assistance for our high school age athletes, and upon leaving our system, every player receives 1 year of college or vocational school education paid for by the clubs for every year they play with the team. To be clear, every player is eligible for a year of college for every year they play for us. 4 years playing for us means 4 years college education. In fact, we are just as proud of our alumni that have gone on to become doctors, lawyers, electricians, and plumbers as we are of our NHL graduates. Each year, over 350 players take advantage of their fully guaranteed WHL scholarship to attend post-secondary institutions. Since 1993, over 5,500 WHL graduate players have benefited from the WHL scholarship program. In conclusion, our system invests heavily in providing a world-class hockey experience for all of our players. The players' well-being and the WHL's highest is the WHL's highest priority. The Western Hockey League's world-class player experience includes the highest caliber of coaching and training facilities, extensive health and safety initiatives, as well as anti-doping and mentorship programs. In short, we, along with our players and their families, believe the WHL experience is one of the greatest youth development programs in the world. Thank you, Chair Holvey, and members of the committee for allowing me to testify.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. I understand long tradition, good legacy, but I'm trying to sort out my brain. So the players do not get any type of financial pay. They only get housing and other associated costs.
They get a small expense stipend to cover like gas expense and that sort of thing, but like, they don't get
like
paid.
How small? What's the?
Like $100 a month.
Okay. Okay.
And then they live with billet families. I don't know if you understand that system, but every player has to live with a family. So they, and then we pay the billet family to house them and feed them and that sort of thing.
The reason for my question is, until very recently, volunteer firefighters could actually get a little bit of money for taking family out to dinner and things like that. But the federal government said, now you can't receive a penny. Mm. And we depend upon about 70% of the state is protected by volunteer firefighters.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to make sure that in this particular case, if we grant the exemption, we're being relatively consistent.
Understood.
Representative Heck.
Thank you, Chair. The $100 stipend that they get, do they get a 1099 or some sort of a tax form?
No.
Okay, so can I follow up?
Follow
Thank
up.
You. So my concern with that would be I know that scholarship athletes are required to report that on their taxes as a form of income.
Mm-hmm.
So why would they not be required to do the same?
I'd have to look. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
Can I have a follow?
Because
I would assume it's over $500.
Per player?
Year. Per year, per player, per year?
It would be over 500. It would be about $600 per player per year. $100 a month.
Okay.
$100.
Thank you. I'd like to see something in that regard done, simply because it's, you know, and then they get the earned income tax credit. They get those things when they file their tax return, which is a good thing for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that might be something that you look into that, probably ought to be done similar to what a college athlete has happened, because I know that that's, you know, they get their scholarship and they get this, a 1098, I believe, or something that then has to be filed with their return. I don't think it hurts them necessarily, but it's part of the process. Yeah,
yeah,
I'd like to see that.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yep.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question's surround making sure that college athletes are not exploited like we see in football and basketball, in my opinion. So my question is, who bears the cost of their health insurance and their injuries?
We have the insurance. We bear that cost. USA Hockey has to carry that, and as a member of USA Hockey, they carry all the insurance for the players. And we pay those premiums.
And the injuries?
Well,
their lifetime injuries.
Follow up.
Okay. So in workers' compensation, if you're injured on the job and it's a life-changing injury, that injury is covered forever. basically. And if you exclude them from being able to access that, then after they're out of the league, they bear the cost of that injury.
Yeah, USA Hockey covers those injuries.
For life?
Yes. I'm sure of it. I'll double check, but I'm there. We've never had any issue with that.
Chair Holby, Representative Bynum, if I can interject as well, I do want to make clear that the important thing to remember with this bill is we are not changing anything under current practice. So, I mean, currently there is an exemption specifically in work comp that covers these and all amateur athletes from high school football all the way, swimming, track, whatever it may be. I just want to make that clear that we are not changing anything there. We are just, I think, clarifying and putting in statute what is the current process already, how we currently recognize amateur athletes like Portland Winterhawk players.
Representative Heck.
One more, Chair. Thank you. Are these amateur athletes held to the same standards as an amateur college athlete as far as who regulates them for controlled substance use, all those things like that? I know that the NCAA does and the NAIA and those folks regulate our college athletes. What happens to who regulates? If these are amateur athletes, who regulates to make sure that?
Both the Western Hockey League and the Canadian Hockey League have massive regulations. They do all the testing. We also have to do that to comply with our USA Hockey and Hockey Canada. Hockey Canada is the equivalent of USA Hockey in Canada. And so both of those provide all those regulations.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other questions? Not seeing any. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here.
Thank you.
I do want to recognize the pages that we had in the room today. I thought maybe they were here to testify on this bill, but it doesn't appear so. I hope you pages have a good day, and thank you for being here. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill, or there was anyone else that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 901. Pages obviously didn't. No one else. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 901A. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 41A. So, Graham Slater.
Committee members, this is a measure introduced by the Employment Department. It clarifies that the department may disclose information in their department records to public universities and the Oregon Health and Science University. Authorize the department to disclose to any person establishment level information that's secured from public universities and the OHSU. Update citation to the Federal Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, and it updates administrative duties and authorities of the director concerning workforce and labor data analyses. And it clarifies that home care workers are not state employees for the purposes of workforce and labor market information. And finally, it repeals an obsolete statute regarding the occupational program planning system. The Senate vote on this measure was 25-5, and there are no amendments today.
Thank you. Welcome. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, Chair Holby, members of the committee. My name is Graham Slater, and I serve as the Deputy Director for the Oregon Employment Department. So thanks for the chance to share a few comments with you on Senate Bill 41A today. A little bit of background, the Research Division at the Employment Department are the group that collect and publish all the data on employment, things like unemployment rates that got a lot of attention recently, how many jobs there are in different industries, the wages that are paid for different jobs, what kinds of training programs might be relevant for the jobs 10 or more years from now. We, the Research Division, rarely request statutory changes. Our statute's pretty simple. Once every few years, there's enough small things that we think it's sort of worth coming before you and asking to make these kind of updates. So that's what we're doing today. We did discuss these with a variety of federal, state, local partner stakeholders, a year ago, basically, when we were first forming this, and in recent times, and to our knowledge, everybody's supportive on board. There's no controversy. So as Jan mentioned, there's three main things that we're asking to do here. The first one is to update ORS 657-730, which is the statute that describes the duties and responsibilities of the research division that the Employment Department Director is responsible for. The statute was put in place in the early 1990s, and of course there's a few things different since then. The main thing we want to do is to update some things that were important then that nobody even wants us to do anymore, but they're still in statute. So that is just kind of a cleaning up. We're not taking anything away that people want us to do. We're simply clearing out. And I'll give you a couple of examples in a second. We also want to update references to new federal laws, including the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, which is a major guiding statute over the workforce system, including the statistical system. The bill will update 657-734, which talks about the workforce system's performance measures. Again, it's just eliminating a reference to something that doesn't even exist anymore. And as Jan mentioned, it repeals the Oregon Occupational Planning System, which is 657-736, which was basically a huge stack of papers about occupations and careers, which is now simply an online web tool because this happened before the internet. So, I mean, we would not dream of printing that out into the kind of document that was foreseen. Number two, it clarifies that we can continue to share confidential information in a limited way for limited purposes with Oregon's public universities. This is not a change. It's simply confirming now that the universities have a different organizational and governance structure that we continue doing what we've always done, but we wanted that to be clear for us and for people that come after us. And it grants the same status to the Oregon Health Science University, which is also important because their governance status is a little bit unusual. When we requested an amendment on the Senate side, the folks from the public employee retirement system asked us also to include a very small amendment for them relative to our research statute. And that is that currently we can share information with PERS for the purposes of determining eligibility for PERS members under their disability programs under ORS 238, which covers PERS Tiers 1 and 2. And they've asked us to simply include also 238A, which would include the members of the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan. So it, again, is just making that consistent with what's needed for them to do their jobs. The number three thing is about home care workers. Those are individuals who provide services to the elderly and to people with disabilities. Previous legislation clearly stated that home care workers are not state government employees for any purpose, and then there were some exceptions added, one of which was for the purpose of the payment of unemployment insurance benefits. When that exception was put in statute, it simply said, with the exception of ORS 657, which isn't just about unemployment insurance, it's about everything the Employment Department does. So we need to make, or we want to make the change to say that is for unemployment insurance. The unintended consequence of that was that from that point on, these home care workers who work for private individuals, they're referred by a state agency, but they're not state employees. They are currently showing up in the data, in our research data, as state employees. And that is not what was intended. It really doesn't make sense. It's not consistent with other states or the nation. So we want to fix that. And my big statement on this one is that the proposal changes nothing in the real world for the home care workers or for the people that they serve. It simply makes the statistics accurate and relevant and comparable to other states. So again, the bill is about updating the statute on workforce and labor market information. We don't believe there's any controversy. We've talked to, we think, all the right people. And it doesn't change anything sort of in the real world for Oregonians or Oregon businesses. It simply makes the data and the statistics better. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll happily take questions or I can be done.
Questions from the committee. So what is the unemployment rate right now?
3.8%, Representative. A record low.
A record low. How about the participation rate?
I don't have that one memorized.
I just thought.
Right.
All right. Thanks. I appreciate your testimony today. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that wants to testify on Senate Bill 41A? Seeing I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 41A. That's open right. A public hearing on Senate Bill 42.
Mr. Chair and committee members, another bill from the Employment Department. This bill reverses amendments to statute that was made by Senate Bill 1534 in the 2016 session that subsequently was determined by the U.S. Secretary of Labor to be out of conformity with federal law. No expenditure impacts, no revenue impacts. Senate vote 25-5 and no amendments.
Thank you. Welcome this afternoon. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Hovey, members of the committee. I'm David Gerstenfeld, the Unemployment Insurance Division Director at the Oregon Employment Department, testifying in favor of Senate Bill 42, which deals with unemployment insurance. A little bit of background. The unemployment insurance program is administered by states in a partnership with the federal government. States have some leeway as to how they structure and operate their program, but there are federal requirements that we have to stay consistent with. If we stray from being consistent with those federal requirements, the consequences can include losing the administrative grant that we get from the federal government to run the unemployment insurance program, and also Oregon employers losing a credit that they currently receive against their federal unemployment tax, their FUTA obligation. That would mean that if you're out of conformity with federal requirements, it could be up to about $500 million a year in additional payroll taxes for Oregon businesses. And I mention that because that's largely why we're here talking about Senate Bill 42. There's a general provision in federal law that says that school employees typically cannot get unemployment insurance benefits during school breaks. The federal law classifies employees into two groups for this purpose, and I'm using the federal terminology. They have professional and non-professional employees. States generally have a little bit more flexibility with administering the program for the non-professional employees. So in 2016, Senate Bill 1534 was passed, which made a very small exception to the general rule that school employees don't get benefits during breaks. And it said that for non-professional employees, if they voluntarily quit their job but had a good enough reason that they were getting benefits, those benefits wouldn't stop during the school breaks. So this was a relatively minor exception. We estimated that it was about 50 or so people a year that would be impacted. Importantly, 1534 also had a provision that said if it was found to be inconsistent with federal law, it would not go into effect. And as Jan said, we did get notice from the federal government that it was not consistent with federal law, which is why Senate Bill 42 was introduced to repeal those provisions, because we didn't want language in the statutes that was not actually effective, which would be confusing. And legislative counsel asked us to kind of clean up that language. The additional wrinkle is that in December of 2016, the U.S. Department of Labor issued new guidance that was pretty extensive about unemployment insurance for school employees. One of the things that it did is it said that the policy enacted by Senate Bill 1534 was no longer prohibited. It was now required to be in place by states, and it had to apply not just to the non-professional employees, but to all school employees. So we still want to proceed with Senate Bill 42 because the language on the books now is still confusing. If you read the statute, it looks like that would only apply to non-professional employees, and it's required under federal law to apply to all educational employees. With the repeal of Senate Bill 1534, with those changes, we do have the authority to implement that required policy. We already did that actually through temporary rulemaking so that it would be in place for this past spring break, and we'll do permanent rulemaking before that temporary rule expires. I did want to mention that guidance that came out in December covered a lot of other aspects of issues related to school employees and unemployment insurance benefits. And at your request, Chair Hovey, we're happy to work with you and other interested stakeholders to explain what those other impacts may be and what policy options it presents. But Senate Bill 42 is really just that very narrow issue of cleaning up the statutory language. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I think Representative Barreto might have been on that work group in 2016, but yeah, I understand we still have to have some conversations about the upcoming rules regarding this issue area. So I think we're moving ahead, trying to get something scheduled so we can address this while we're in session, or at least get the conversation going anyway. And I don't know if we've picked a date yet, Jan, have we?
Mr. Chair, The date will be Friday, May 19th, 10:30. So I have a list of people who have been wanting to participate, and I was including the elected members who participated in the 2015 work group. But if I guess if there's other committee members who want to be included in that, to just let me know.
Right. So I just wanted to put that out to everybody. It's a little complex, I guess, to say the least, trying to understand all the different applications of unemployment insurance for school employees. So I appreciate that. Are there any questions about Senate Bill 42? Not seeing any, David. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else that want to testify on Senate Bill 42? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 42 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 980A.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a bill that can't find the file for. Introduced by the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation, it establishes requirements for vehicle manufacturers to compensate the dealer franchisees who perform repairs on vehicles that are subject to a safety recall. It also requires a manufacturer to compensate the dealer who has to hold a used vehicle that is subject to a safety recall while waiting for parts to be provided. And finally, the measure prohibits the manufacturer from retaliating against a dealer who submits a claim for compensation under the Act.
All right. So I have signed up Bill Perry and
Greg
Rimmensperger. Apologize.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. Appreciate the opportunity today. So this bill, as of right now, if a new car gets a safety recall, meaning the dealer can't sell it, there's a process for compensation in statute currently. What happens is if you take a car and trade in, that no longer applies. So what we're trying to do is get some sort of the same kind of a system applies to cars that aren't no longer new. And obviously the depreciation on the vehicles after they drive off the lot goes at a quicker rate. So there are different issues that are involved here. So this bill is a product. We work with the different manufacturer representatives in the Senate to derive the main. A lot of them are technical in nature, and so I think a lot of that was agreed upon. The big issue was really the compensation rate, which is probably not surprising to anybody. And so we derived on something that we feel was acceptable by everybody, which is they do not have to compensate for the first 30 days, gives them a grace period, and then you compensate at 1.5% of the trade-in value, not the retail value, but the trade-in value. And so there are several different states. I think there are four of them right now that are at that same level. So it seems to be the standard that is moving across the country in different states. So be happy to answer any questions if you'd like.
Go ahead.
Chair Holvey and committee members, my name is Greg Rimmensperger. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Oregon Auto Dealers, representing the franchise dealers. As Bill mentioned, this is a bill that kind of is modeled after a number of other states that are passing similar legislation, and we appreciate the work with the Alliance of Auto Manufacturers and the Global Automakers to come up with something that would be synonymous with what was happening in other states. The fees that a dealer has to pay in flooring interest and so forth when a vehicle is grounded for a safety recall is really what's the issue here. I think most of us are familiar with the Takata airbag issue, where there was safety issues for drivers of the vehicle if that airbag deployed. So the vehicles were stopped and the dealers had to sit on the vehicles for in excess of a year in some cases. And that still was showing up on their flooring and they were paying interest. This would give them compensation for that type of scenario. And again, there's a 30-day grace period that allows the manufacturers to come up with a solution to the problem before it kicks in. And then it kicks in at 1.5% for every month until you reach the value of the vehicle.
All right.
Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So why did this have to come through legislation and not negotiation between the franchisees and the franchisors?
Chair Holvey and Vice Chair Bynum and committee members, typically what happens in franchise issues is the National Auto Dealers Association tries to take a run at a national solution for it, but if not, it goes to state to run it on separate state-by-state issues. We worked with a number of other states and the two representatives to try and come up with something, because there's so many manufacturers that all have a different opinion and so forth that it could get more convoluted the more it got stretched out from manufacturer to manufacturer, state by state. So this was a solution that would allow the manufacturers to have something that was universal in the states that passed legislation like this. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Other questions? Seeing any, gentlemen, thank you very much for walking us through the bill.
Thank you.
No one else signed up on Senate Bill 980A. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 980A and open a work session on Senate Bill 21. Jan, remind us what this is about.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this is the bill that you heard last week from the Board of Accountancy, and it dealt with their ability to disclose confidential information when an investigation is pending. Minimal expenditure impact, no revenue impact. Senate vote was 28-0, no amendment.
Shall we have a motion?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 21 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bynum moves Senate Bill 21 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Kayla, could we have a roll call, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Pack?
Aye.
Representative Hart?
Aye.
Representative Penner.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto.
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum.
Aye.
Chair Holvey.
Aye. Senate Bill 21 passes. And is there an objection to putting this on the consent calendar? It does talk about disclosing confidential information to certain public entities. No objection?
Controversial.
Yeah, no objection. Well, let's put this on the consent calendar. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 21. Open a work session on Senate Bill 67.
Mr. Chair, this is the measure that came from the Oregon Real Estate Agency. Defines terms and statutes that are related to real estate, clarifies language related to the system for registration and renewal of the business names for businesses regulated by the agency. It exempts certain checks from requirements to be deposit funds into the client's trust account, requires the real estate licensees to notify the agency of certain activities related to the client's trust accounts, and it prohibits certain individuals from sharing compensation paid to a real estate licensee. No expenditure impact, no revenue impact, no amendment, and the Senate vote was 28-0.
Thank you. Could we have a motion on this bill? Representative Bynum.
67. 67. 67. I pulled up the wrong one. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 67 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bynum moves Senate Bill 67 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Well, I just want to clarify, I still think it's co-mingle, just to put that on the record. So. So.
Maybe this bill is controversial.
So, Kayla, can we have a roll call, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Pack?
Aye.
Representative Hurd.
Aye.
Representative Summers.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto.
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum.
Aye.
Chair Holby.
Aye. Senate Bill 67 and receive the votes is passed. Representative Hack, thank you for volunteering for that one.
No problem.
Did she know about that?
Thrilled, I think she was.
Then I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 67 and open a work session on Senate Bill 92.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is the measure that came from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It gives the director of that department authority to set maximum penalties for violations of the occupational safety and health requirements and to follow, to use as guidelines the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Act. And no amendment, no revenue impact. A fiscal statement has been issued, and the Senate vote on this was 21-8.
Thank you. And a motion on this bill.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 92 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bynum moves Senate Bill 92 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Barreto.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm going to be a no on this as far as increasing or allowing them to set increases. So, and one of the other things I guess I was thinking of too, if we set these fines the same as federal OSHA, why do we have a state and a federal OSHA? Why wouldn't we just combine it into one and maybe save the state some money? Sir.
Well, if that's a question, I'd probably call up Michael Wood, give us an answer to that question. I don't want to try to answer it for him.
Let me repeat it.
And welcome. If you'd identify yourself for the record, and if would you like him to repeat the question?
For the record, my name is Michael Wood. I'm the administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, Oregon OSHA. As I understood the question, it's if we set the same penalties as federal OSHA, why have a federal OSHA and a state OSHA? I guess my answer to the question would be twofold. First, there's a good deal of other flexibility and latitude we get separate and apart from what we do with regard to penalties. And in relation to penalties, I think it's important to emphasize that we will not have the same penalties as federal OSHA as a result of this change. We will have the same maximum penalties and the same minimums in the statute. We've had the same maximum and minimums as federal OSHA until the change they enacted a year and a half ago since the act was in place, because it's always been an expectation of the federal law that we have the same penalty authority as federal OSHA. We apply it differently. During all that time, when we've had the same maximums as federal OSHA, we've had a $7,000 maximum for many years. They've had a $7,000 maximum. Their average penalty for a first-time serious violation for many years has been about $2,200. Our average penalty for a first-time serious violation has hovered in the neighborhood of about $400 to $450. So this wouldn't make our penalties the same. It would make our maximum penalty authority the same and the maximum penalty for a willful violation the same. And that is an expectation of federal OSHA as one of the minimum requirements we have to continue to operate our own program.
Thank you. Other questions, other discussion?
Thank you.
Not seeing any. Kayla, could we have a roll call, please?
Representative Jordan?
Aye.
Representative Evans? Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Pack?
No.
Representative Hurd?
No.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
No.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 92, having received the votes, is passed. And Representative Doherty, would you like to carry this one?
Sure.
Thank you. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 92. Open a work session on Senate Bill 94.
Mr. Chair, committee members, another bill from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. You heard this just Monday. And this is a bill that deals with raising the threshold on which projects must provide the enhanced sanitary facilities. This bill has no amendment, there's no expenditure impact, and there's no revenue impact. Senate vote on this was 26-0.
Thank you. And Representative Bynum. Representative Barreto.
Yes, sir.
Would you like to make a motion?
Yeah, Chair Holby, I move Senate Bill 94 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barreto moves Senate Bill 94 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Bynum.
I struggled with this because I know that there's an additional cost to providing, basically it's hand washing on construction sites. And if we are trying to attract more women into our trades, I think that sanitary facilities need to accommodate both sexes fairly. And moving this requirement up, in my opinion, does not do that. So I think this is an equity issue.
So. Thank you. Any your comments?
Oh, why not?
Representative Heck, more discussion?
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to be a no today, too. I guess I just really couldn't wrap my head around why we need less of them versus more. We talk about wanting more women in trades, more women out in the field, and then I kind of tend to agree with Rep. Bynum here. I don't know why we would reduce the number of those, so I just really anyway, I'll be a no. Enough said.
This is getting more interesting. Any other discussion?
I guess we're not going to put this on the consent agenda.
It doesn't look like it.
Battle of the sexes.
Kayla, could we have a roll call, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Adams?
Yes.
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Hatt?
No.
Representative Hurd?
Yes.
Representative Kennemer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
No.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 94, having received the votes, is passed.
I'll be hard enough. Yeah.
And who would like to carry this bill?
I think Hack should carry it.
I'll give it a whirl, all right.
I will carry it for you, Chair.
Oh, thank you. Oh. I was hoping somebody would bail me out here.
Actually, we missed our chance.
Oh.
That's what I was
with that, about. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 94.
Margaret, ladies.
And I think it's probably a good time to adjourn this committee. With that, I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor. Adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor. With that, I'm going to